accession number 27194, Reel 3.
Mr. Foster, Reel 3. You're saying that you were doing more advanced training as well as guarding the tanks at Falmouth.
Yes.
And you described doing company attacks.
That's right.
Did you do any battalion training at that time?
Yeah, well, the battalion would come together for... Yes, of course they were. Yeah, the companies would come together on a battalion exercise. Yes, they would. That's why.
Was that a frequent occurrence?
Not very frequent, because most people were tied down on this guarding business. Yeah, that was our main activity, the guarding. Yeah.
Where were you actually accommodated when you were in Falmouth? Were you in a regular barracks?
In private house. Empty houses. Houses were commandeered, and we were piling into the house, and all the furniture would have, everything cleared out, bare floors, and we would sleep on the floor. I remember we never had beds. We never seemed to have beds in the room. It was always sleeping on the floor somewhere. We got used to that. Yeah.
Did you have sleeping bags, or did you have?
No, just blankets and palliasse. Palliasse filled with straw, with a little pillow, and your blankets, and you made your bed. And in the morning, you folded it up, laid it out as per kit plate. All the kit. Yeah.
What about entertainment and recreation while you were doing this? Was there anything you could do to entertain yourselves?
Gosh, yes, there were. The pictures were still operating.
In
cinema? Yes, yeah, when we're going to the pictures. And some nice girls in Falmouth. I can remember going swimming in Swan Pool, midnight swimming, which wasn't allowed, but it happened. And shops and canteens, yeah, there were some very good canteens were started up. Some by the Salvation Army and by the Church, Church of England and the Methodists, YMCA, they all very quickly got the canteens going, and they were absolutely marvellous, because lovely ladies there would, you could have suppers and chat and stuff. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I got the impression earlier on that you'd always enjoyed reading. Were you able to carry on with that?
Certain amount, yes. Yeah, you could sometimes get a bit of peace and quiet and read in the back room when all the drunken ones had gone out and pubs. A little bit, not very much, but a little bit, yes.
Yeah. I mean, was there a circulating library or anything of that sort to provide you with books?
Can't remember a circulating library, no, I can't. But, of course, the main entertainment was... Really, in the billet, with different chaps. I mean, we seem to have a good lot of comedians. I mean, for instance, one chap had his trade declared as Punch and Judy man. No one believed him, but he sounded as if he could have been a Punch and Judy man. And another chap put his trade down as a poet. Which they ordered a clerk, because poets weren't allowed in the book. Poets weren't allowed. So we seem to have a good proportion of comedians. So a certain amount of entertainment went on all the time, more or less. You know, just by normal fatting around. Yeah.
Now in June 1940, I think you were moved suddenly to
Newhaven.
Coastal Defence, Newhaven, yes.
Yeah, yeah. This was about the fall of France.
Had you been aware of what had been going on in France?
Well, we didn't realise that the situation was so disastrous. No, we didn't, obviously. We just believed that the BEF there and the French army would be able to cope with whatever was going to happen in the war, whether we were going to attack Germany or whether they would push from their side. So when we heard about the fall of France, of course, that was disastrous. And we moved to New Haven, and there again it was guarding the docks and the port, taking positions all around New Haven, expecting a German invasion at any minute. So we were then occupied day and night. We seemed to get no sleep at all, you know, hardly any. And there were crashed German aircraft to sort of guard and round up any survivors, things like that. I remember attending a funeral of one German pilot. We had to learn a new drill of the funeral service for well, really, it wasn't just for an enemy, it was for one of us, where you had resting on your arms reversed, which is a brand new thing, the rifle upside down and that, and firing volleys in the air and things like that. So that was a bit of a diversion. Most of the time there, there was, again, on patrolling all around New Haven at night and day, digging positions for all-round defence of New Haven as a very vulnerable port, obviously. And helping with the bombing. New Haven was bombed. Several quite severe air raids on New Haven. And in one of them, the billet I was in, which was the convent there, where the nuns were separated out on one part of the convent, and we occupied the other in New Haven. In one raid, the convent was bombed, and the part that the nuns occupied was took most of the flak, and some of the nuns were killed, and we helped to, you know, get them out, and also to restore, yeah,
border. Rescue work.
That's right. Yeah.
Was there effective anti-aircraft defence at New Haven at that time?
Well, I very well, but I think it was fairly good. We seem to hear a lot of them thumping away. Yes, yeah, I think they were fairly good. As far as I can remember, I'm not sure about that.
Did you actually see it?
Some planes were brought down, Germans were brought down, but I'm not sure whether that was by our fighters or
by
the anti-aircraft. Yeah. Some were definitely brought down, yes.
Did you actually yourself see any German Luftwaffe?
Oh, yes, we used to see them, yes, yeah, and we saw the dogfights going on when. We can remember the scores, the... excuse me.
You were saying you saw the dogfights overhead.
Yes, and there was a daily score. This was the height of the Battle of Britain, and there were the daily scores of hundreds odd of the Luftwaffe fighters and bombers shot down. And one day we reached... I say we, but... the news was that we reached the highest score, whatever that was, best part of 200 bombers shot down. And I mean, on the ground, we thought, well, that's absolutely marvellous, and that, you know, we were going to survive, all of us. So that went on. We saw all the dogfights. So our chaps shooting up the Jerrys, and of course some of our chaps coming down as well. We had our casualties, so we were part of all that, yes.
Did you actually see any of the aircrew themselves, the German aircrew? Did you?
Oh yes, when several of them that were shot down, we had to round them up.
What impression did they make on you when you saw them?
Oh, I thought... I mean, it seems strange now, but somehow we expected them to look different to us. I mean, a different uniform and all the rest of it, obviously, but we thought they looked sort of frightened and, you know, horror-struck that they'd been shot down. and captured some, and then again there were some who appeared to be very defiant and sort of autocratic. You know, we're the German Luftwaffe, and expect to be treated with due reverence, sort of thing. And so there was a mixture there, but the others were quite frightened, the worst of it. So we started to get a picture then of the enemy, which we hadn't had before, obviously. So we thought, well, yes, they're going to be good, they're strong, they're brave, and they're going to take an awful lot of beating. So we had that sort of thing in mind then. Without meeting soldiers, but from the Luftwaffe, yes. Yeah.
What did you actually do with them when you picked them up?
We had them over to the military police, who would smartly come and take them away. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned preparing positions around New Haven for
yes.
around defence. Were these just the ordinary standard dug positions, or did you have anything with which to strengthen them? Did you have good supplies of wire, for example?
Oh, yes.
You know, mines to lay
in? Yeah, we laid out. First of all, we would have to dig the trenches, sort of arrowhead formation or whatever,
yes.
for sections and platoons. Digging into the chalk and the flints was hard going, I remember. Mm. And the chaps who did best at that were the Cornish chaps, because quite a few of them had been in the Cornish mines, and they were able to dig twice as good as we, the rest of us, could, Londoners and all sorts. So we were duly impressed by their digging, and they were damn good. So we dug all these positions, and they had to command all the area around New Haven. And then we would lay out miles of wire, trip wires and such like, lay mines. Our pioneer platoon would lay the mines, because we were then got used to all the platoons doing their different jobs, of course. I was a rifle platoon, but the specialist platoons, like the mortars, 2-inch mortar chaps, pioneers did mine laying and stuff, and picking up mines. And then we would fortify the houses as well.
How did you do that?
Well, we would shore up the walls, strengthen the walls, you know, with concrete, filling in with concrete to make them stronger. Overhead protection. Engineers would come and help us with that, the Royal Engineers. Reinforcing walls with timber and all sorts to make a strong position, to withstand, to a certain extent, shelling and, of course, machine gun fire. So we have fortified houses all around New Haven, along with the trench system, with converging fields of fire and everything like that. And out on the beach, there was wire and scaffolding started to be put up, with mines attached, and noon safe alleyways to come back through and all that kind of thing. So all that went on. And that was improved and continued all around the country, of course. Well, all the vulnerable areas, the East Coast, particularly the East Coast, South Coast, East Coast, down here, Plymouth.
It sounds as though it was a rather comprehensive effort at coastal defence.
Well, it was a tremendous thing. Yes, it was, because
big an area did you have to cover as a company? Did you have a particular area that was your area of responsibility, or were you moved periodically from one area to another?
Well, a company would have to erect to cover, about a quarter of a mile or something like that. Yeah. And then the companies would be moved gradually from one area to another, so they all got used to the whole field of...
The whole layout.
The whole layout, that's right. Yeah.
What was your role at that time? Were you still a rifleman?
I was still a rifleman then, yes. And then in 1941, After Newhaven, we moved up to the East Coast.
You were up to Thorn, weren't you, in Yorkshire?
That's right, yes. Yes, Thorn.
What was that like?
Thorn. We lived in my company, D Company. We lived in a workhouse in Thorn. All the inmates had been dispersed. We took over the workhouse. Typical Dickens workhouse with a little exercise yard in the middle. We lived in there, and our job there, I mean, being in the middle of the country or north, instead of coast defense, we did training, battalion training, very long route marches, longer than any we'd done before.
How?
20 miles sort of things, and 25 miles and this.
Where had you done route marches before? This been at, pardon? Where had you done that before? That been at Seaton Barracks? You started route marching here in Plymouth? Or?
Oh, yeah, we've done short route marches
yes.
here. But up there, we went for these longer marches. And the
how long would you go for from here on a short march? What would count as a short route march?
Well, about 20 miles.
20 so. Miles is a short one?
Well, reasonably, yes, because we did longer ones than that, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So up in Yorkshire, how far would you be going up there?
Well, we'd go from Thorn to Stainforth and Goole, Doncaster, all around that area.
So this is in south east Yorkshire, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah, yeah. This is centred on Doncaster, more or less, mm. yeah. And we were there for about 3 or 4 months, something like that. And that was field training on a higher level than we'd done before.
So it was battalion level rather
yes,
than company level.
That's right.
So you're going up the scale, aren't you, from platoon?
Yeah, we were moving up.
And
yeah.
you mentioned doing these long marches. Were these long marches done just for toughening you up, or was there a tactical purpose behind it?
I think it was mainly for toughening up then, because we were in 4-5 Div, Drake's Drum. And I can't remember who else was in the division now, but I think the general accent was on general toughening up, because the thinking then was that we'd been kicked out of France, and we had to prove ourselves, and it was going to be a long war, it was going to be a hard one. And no one quite knew what was going to happen, you know, the strategic effort. But that we had to be as hard as nuts, and there wasn't an ounce of flesh to spare anywhere, sort of thing. That was the pressure then.
What about tactical training and manoeuvres? Did you do any of those?
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, yeah, quite a bit of that in Thorn. I remember the country around there, pretty wild. Moorland, and
well,
we spent most
there?
Of our time out.
Mm. Most of your time out rather than in?
Most of the time out in the field, yes, yeah, we did.
And this was in early spring, so it's December to April that you were at Thorn.
That's right,
yeah, so
yeah. And perhaps going up towards the summer. Mm. And then after Thorn, as far as I remember, we went to moved to the East Coast.
Yes.
Bolton.
Yeah, Walden and the Nays.
That's right.
And when you did the manoeuvres at when you were based at Thorn, were these all battalion level, or do you remember doing anything at brigade level or higher, or would you not have known the difference?
I can't remember anything about brigade at Thorn. No, I just don't. It may well have happened.
Do you remember seeing anything of any of the other arms, of the artillery, for example, or armour or anything like that?
I can't remember any at Thorn, no. I think we were mainly on our own in battalion stuff.
Were you still based on movement by foot, or did you have transport by that stage?
Still had the odd buses and things like that, yes, yeah, coaches to carry us about, but mainly it was on foot.
I think you mentioned that you went to Walton on the Naze, and then again you were back on coastal defence.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
What were you doing at Walton? Was it the same as you've been doing at Newhaven? Or
yeah,
Dipper,
yeah. Anyway? Yeah, more of it, because tremendous long coastline, and we had to put up all the scaffolding and lay out the Dannet wire, mines, oh yes, and pillboxes. You would occupy the... We built quite a lot of pillboxes, and then you would occupy them day and night, continuous, that's right, all along that area of the coast. Walton, Frinton, and inland to Colchester we would go for exercises, to and fro all the time. And it was at Walton that we had opportunities to, there was an invitation to volunteer for the signal platoon, which I jumped into.
Why was that? Why did you decide to become a signaler?
I thought it was more my thing. I hadn't been a particularly good rifleman, not a terribly good shot. So the obvious natural thing was to think you could try to do the thing you could do best. And I had a theory from what I learned about the signals, and we saw them operating on line and lamp and the radio. I thought perhaps I could do rather better at that than I was doing with a rifle.
But so, you were a good machine gunner, weren't you? You were good on the Bren.
The Bren saved my life. I mean, I enjoyed firing the Bren, but I didn't enjoy firing the rifle, so I suppose there was a thing there that on balance, I thought, oh, I could do rather better in the signals. So I volunteered for the signals.
Was there a selection test you had to pass?
Yes, you had. What would happen, you were trained in laying lines, semaphore flags, and the telephone and the exchange, and the radio. We had number 18 sets. Lamp signalling, the army version of the oldest lamp. All that, and then after training for about 3 months, raw signals would come, a detachment of raw signals, and they would take you through a test, a Morse test, where you had to reach about 10 words a minute, and all the other things with the radio and the line and all that. There were about 12 of us in the class, and I think 3 passed, and I was one of the failures on that first one. The reason being that on the lamp signalling, when you had to send a message and then read from a far station, read to a chap who will copy down behind you from the Morse code, my eyes filled with tears because the cold wind was blowing. And I just made a mess of the message.
You couldn't see the other lamp then?
Well, I saw the lamp, but I made so many mistakes. Yeah. So I failed on that. And if you failed on one thing, you were out. So there was nothing else, but I was recommended to have another try.
So you went through the class again?
Went through the class again.
How long did the course last?
Another 3 months course.
3 months conducted in the regiment?
That's right, oh yes. Yeah.
Who actually trained you within the regiment?
The sergeant who I said before had rollocked me about going on about the second front when we weren't ready for it.
Ah.
Sergeant Bob Gould.
Sergeant Robert, tell me about that rollicking then.
Well, that was when I was ranting off in the barrack room that everybody was fighting the war except us. And he said, your job is to train and be ready to fight when your time comes. And then you must do your stuff, not rant on now and shut up, you know, just keep on with your training. Bob Gould, that was, who trained us, and Frank Grigg.
Do you think that this feeling that, you know, just training all the time, not fighting, was not the thing, was that a common feeling in the...
Yes, it was,
You know, the war was dragging on and you weren't doing anything.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a general feeling, which we had damn good instructors and officers who countered that by trying to make training interesting. But there was that feeling of Burnaby. You would have felt the same yourself, wouldn't you?
I'm sure that, you know, prolonged periods of training in static defence are demoralising, unless there's some final end in sight.
As time went on, you see, this is 42, 41, 42, by early, late 43, I should think, we had we realised more of the strategic position and how far we'd had to go to build up all arms of the service in order to mount the invasion, and what a tremendous thing it was going to be, that we then became more settled to the idea that our job was to prepare and train.
Of a sense of purpose.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
You were mentioning the means of communication, and that you had the line, you had the wireless, you had the signal flags, and you had the lamp. Do you think that the semaphore system was still of any real practical use?
Semaphore?
Yes.
Well, we used it on convoys and things, where it was a quick way of getting a message from here to there, you know, in daylight, obviously. Yes. And we had worked up in Inverary on this hookbook training. Later, of course, we found it was useful because the Navy were using it.
Ah, so you had to read naval signals.
Yes. There was a difference. The Navy, I don't know if you ever did any semaphore yourself, but the Army system was very rigid in that it was A, B, C, D, E, F, that sort of thing, you know, the two flags. All rigid signals. The Navy, if you've ever seen them on films and things, I mean, I don't think they use it now, obviously, but their signals were more loose, like that, you know, rhythmical. Instead of, they had to be different, the Navy, which of course they were, I mean, they'd always used it. So, yes, it was useful. Also, it was a drill, I mean, semaphore drill, as opposed to foot drill. Semaphore drill was a good means of getting a chap's alert and active.
And under control.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the lamp? Did you ever think, have you ever used the lamp in action?
Well, we were rather doubtful about it, but it was a good exercise in observation, in being observant and being able to quickly read the Morse. We used to use it on night exercises and things. But obviously it was a limited thing, yeah.
Did you ever deal with the helio?
No, we used to hear about it from the regular soldiers, NCOs and that. We used to hear about the helio and the marvellous things that in India they had done from helio from one mountain to another in the Himalayas, or the Himalayas, for hundreds of miles, and were duly impressed by that. But we never had.
You mentioned you had the 18 set.
Yes.
How did you get on with that? Was it a reliable?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was extremely good. And up to a short distance, depending on the weather and the country, of course, but up to a few miles, yeah, it was pretty good. Before you had good spot-on operators who could tune the thing exactly. You had separate transmitter and receiver, and you tuned them separately. And you had a heterodyne whistle in the middle, which you got into that one, and you were netted. We would have up to a dozen sets on the same frequency. We would work from 6 to 9 megacycles, long wave, of course. And a good net was a triumph in that everyone would come up. And with procedure, of course, which was another great subject of procedure, of when to speak and how to speak and all that kind of.
This is for clear voice.
Yes. Yeah. It was a set that was robust. It had all these valves in it, which you could interchange, and you had a spare of valves to carry with you. Quite a good set. It weighed about 35 pounds and carried on your back. Yeah. With rod section aerials, which you could put up for longer distance. You had to choose your as much as you could, choose your country, try and beware of hills and things as much as you possibly could. So a signaller would have to have a very thick skin, in that the company commander would want to sight the set in his headquarters, which could be the worst possible place for communication. So you had a sort of compromise to a certain extent.
And down to what level did you have sets? Did you have sets down to platoon level or just to company level?
Each In the beginning, each company would have an 18 set, just one set in the company, at company headquarters. Later on, I think they got more to platoon level, but in the beginning, it was each company.